Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Once again, we're focusing on arguably the biggest issue in town, the housing crisis. This is part two of two. Last week, we invited three experts to tell us what they thought. This week, it's the turn of Londonist writers to give their view. You've been getting in touch, and thanks for some very warm comments as well. At Blonde Girlfriend says, the podcast today, superb. It's amazing the info one can disseminate when one has no agenda other than to inform and engage. Yeah, absolutely the principles we're working to. Ray Wolford, meanwhile, recommends we talk to peoplebeforeprofit.org.uk, and he says their direct action and occupations changed policy. Different idea here from Peter Smith, who says some good thoughts in the last podcast, but notable that none of them opted for the one policy that would have the biggest benefit, land value tax. Meanwhile, a commenter on the Londonist website, who may not be entirely disinterested party, they're called Jen Rent, says, great podcast, well worth listening to, interesting ideas. But how do we get this on the political agenda? Which party leader will admit they need to bring London house prices down? A very good question, and a comment almost by way of response from regular listener Dominic Stevenson, fantastical Dom on Twitter. He says, very impressed by at Generation Rent on Londonist Out Loud this week. Shame your people don't vote or we'd achieve something. Well, it seems obvious to me that this question of whether renters vote is a big one. Politicians aren't going to act on behalf of renters if renters aren't going to put the X in their box come polling day. And it seems to me that the whole vulnerability and instability of renters' precarious position is geared to them not voting at all. I mean, if you're moving around from borough to borough, for example, let's say every 6 months, every year, whatever it might be, how on earth are you going to get engaged in local politics in that time? Why should you care what's going to happen to the area unless you happen to be a very benevolent sort indeed? You've got no stake in it. And more than that, just the practicalities, as we've seen as the general election approaches, of getting yourself registered to vote in a particular property. I mean that a piece of paper will come through the front door maybe a year, maybe 6 months ahead of the polling day, which means that if you're in a rented property, if you're just arriving, well, you might be arriving after that piece of paper has been delivered and thrown away, and then it's a whole heap of trouble to try and get yourself registered if that's your first priority. And let's face it, it is not your first priority when you move into a new place. In fact, is to locate the local pub and chip shop and find out where the train station and the bus stop are and what's your quickest way to work and where can you put your bike without it getting nicked. I think even the most politically engaged person does not make their first order of business finding out the name of their local MP. Or you might be there in the rented property when the piece of paper turns up, but you've either a full awareness that you'll be leaving the property before the election and moving somewhere else altogether, so that doesn't work for you. Or it might just be part of that temporary mindset where you're just passing through. Why should you get involved? And so I think there's a serious problem. The increasing number of people who are renting and moving around have very little incentive in some ways to vote. Well, of course, I'm not letting people off voting. It's your vote. It's been fought for. And I really think if you care about this stuff, you've got to go out and you've got to claim your vote. But speaking in the last few weeks, as I have to experts and journalists working on this subject, it does seem clear that there's a psychological distance between the person who has a bricks and mortar investment in their local area and the quality of their area is directly reflected in the value of their house, and with somebody who's been moved from pillar to post and may well be resenting that whole process as well. Some of the rental models that we talked about in last week's episode, for instance, let's take the German or French models. Yes, you're renting, but there's a much clearer sense that you have rights and that there is stability and that you've got a stake. But of course, regulatory change that will affect that position is a question of political movement, and that's only going to come about, one would imagine, through votes being cast in a particular way, through an engagement which seems, for the reasons I've just sketched, somewhat unlikely. If it's true that renters don't vote, then that wouldn't surprise me at all. And maybe I'm finding myself, through having these conversations, warming to an idea that so far hasn't been suggested on the show, at least, which would be some sort of compulsory voting. Anyway, that's just my view, and it is most certainly worth less than that of those who have appeared on the show and who've spent substantial chunks of their career specialising in the question of housing. Thank you for your comments. Keep them coming. And while you do so, we will go to Londonist HQ to meet three Londonist writers for the second part of this Londonist Out Loud housing crisis special. Well, hello, hello. We are at Londonist headquarters for the second part of a double bill on housing. Last week, you heard some experts on the subject of housing in London giving their view on the crisis and possible solutions to it. This week, I'm with three writers for Londonist who've been focusing their attentions on the same vexed question. John Elledge, Rachel Holdsworth, Beth Parnell Hopkinson. Hello.
Hello.
What have you been up to? What's been occupying your mind on this subject? Rachel, who I should apologise in advance, Rachel has a cold. You may hear a snuffle or two.
I have not got a cold, I have the flu of death, that's what I've got. So my IQ is like halved at the minute. Actually, right at the minute, I went to speak to the people at Nine Elms, and, you know, they're building 18,000 homes, 3,500, 4,000 affordable homes. And it was really interesting talking to them, because that's all being done without public subsidy. Basically, everything that's been done at Nine Elms is being done from contributions by the developers. So, yeah, you've got all these skyscrapers and it's luxury flats and they are inevitably being flogged off to, you know, investors and everything. But the reason they're doing that is because, I mean, this is partly the problem. It's how we build and it's how we fund. Because there's no mass government investment in housing, it's all having to be done privately. And the only way they can do that and deal with stupidly high land prices in London is to build luxury flats for a huge amount of money and then use that money to build affordable, in inverted commas, housing and more infrastructure. And it's one of those horrible catch-22 situations that we've got ourselves into. This is the only way we can build.
Beth, what have you been working on?
Well, I've been looking at a lot of the regenerations that are going on in London at the moment, particularly where housing, social housing is being replaced by affordable housing, and the social housing allocation has been cut down. One particular example which comes to mind is the Aylesbury Estate in Walworth in South London. The estate is being demolished and rebuilt, but the allocation of social housing is being reduced. The same thing is happening in Leytonstone, where an extra tower is being rebuilt and the current occupants of the two social housing towers are being decanted, as the council have it, into the new tower. But again, the allocation of social housing is being reduced, so there will be some residents who won't have a home to come back to, basically.
John, among the subjects you write about for City Metric, housing features prominently.
Oh, I've mostly been feeling terribly depressed, in all honesty. I spend a lot of my time, as all right-thinking people do, shouting on the internet about land use restrictions, because I'm a firm believer that the only way out of this crisis is basically to build more bloody houses. And the difficulty that you swiftly run into with this is that people, by and large, don't want to. Even people who are at the sharp end of the housing crisis, who are facing extortionate rents or sort of complaining they can't get on the ladder, often don't make any connection between that and the supply and demand curve at work here, and the fact that we just don't have enough housing to go round. As far as I'm concerned, the only way out of that dilemma is to build more housing, which probably means a number of things. It probably means building a higher density in future. It probably means building higher than we have before. And it probably means looking again at the Green Belt and thinking which bits of it are actually worth protecting and are there any bits of it that maybe we could put to better use. But you make these arguments to people and you swiftly find they really don't want to do most of these things. There are very strong, very powerful campaigns out there to protect London's skyline and to protect this intensive farmland on the edge of London and all those lovely golf courses and pony clubs. Those interest groups seem to me to be far stronger than the interest groups currently in favour of building more housing. So I've mostly been crying myself to sleep, in all honesty.
Yes, listener, it's going to be 40 minutes of fun and frolics. Well, that is indeed the message that was coming. Well, no, that's an incorrect representation. But the experts that I spoke to, who, by the way, listener, if you haven't listened to last week's episode, do give that your ear, as that gives some sense of the different options that people think are available. There was a general agreement that there is a housing crisis, different solutions posited in order to come through to the other side. One thing that it seemed to me to be a bottleneck in all of the ideas that were being offered was political will. It seemed in all cases actually to boil down to political self-interest, political short-termism, and everything has to be funneled through that. And I wondered if you are perceiving the same sorts of problems in your research.
I chaired a debate at a conference run by Generation Rent, whose director Alex Hilton was one of your guests last week, on the subject of rent control. And I, this was a room full of people who are, you know, very angry about the housing crisis, angry enough to have shown up to a conference in the middle of the week about it. These are people who are properly furious about this situation. And still, nonetheless, you ask them if they want to sort of look again at where we build housing. Silence. Nobody does. So, you know, I've gone for a long time. I've been working on the assumption that the politicians were kind of behind the electorate here, and that there was a massive surge of enthusiasm for house building coming along the train tracks, and that politics was kind of ignoring that. Having been at that conference, I now sort of think it's the other way round. And if anything, I think the politicians are kind of a bit ahead of the curve, because they are at least talking about it. I mean, no one's coming up with any comprehensive solutions, but it is at least on the agenda. Whereas I think a lot of the voters out there haven't quite got their head around what is necessary to fix this, and you know how we are going to get out of this mess, and that sacrifices are going to have to be made. I think politicians are kind of responding rationally to the incentives the electorate are giving them. I think there is a chance that that will change over time. I mean, the percentage of the British electorate made up of owner-occupier households has already plummeted from a high of, what was it, about 80% at one point, 75, 80? It's down to 63 now, I think, if not lower. So, you know, for the first time, we can envision a future in which, you know, less than half the electorate owns their own home. And at that point, all bets are off.
And yet, we're all homeowners, and yet we're all ranting about we need to build more houses, because we all accept that even if house prices go down, that is actually good for us. I mean, I own my own flat, but I'm stuck in it because if I want to move on, I can't. I can't afford to move somewhere else. It seems to be this mindset that we've all got into, that rising house prices are always good and you always want to have that bit of scrap land across the road, which is technically greenbelt, but it's there. And I don't know, is this some kind of weird British green and present land mindset that we're into?
But yeah, no, I entirely agree that we talk as if the British electorate is split in two, and I was just slipping into it myself, that we talk as if, you know, all owner-occupiers only benefit from rising prices. And that is just complete nonsense, because unless you are planning to downsize or in the last home you're ever going to own, then if you ever want to sort of climb the ladder, then you probably still need prices to be a bit lower, because it doesn't matter if you've got a nice one-bedroom flat if you can't get a family home one day when you want to have kids. But while we discuss, while the debate takes on those terms, it's kind of little wonder to me that politicians think, well, 60% of the electorate still own, we can't possibly bring house prices down. Sorry, young people.
There's a crushing indifference to change in the housing market. And I think this is certainly something that you're seeing as well, John. There's a lot of talk about what we should do and what we could do. But because it would involve such a big sea change for so many people, I think there's less of a will to do it, particularly from the point of view it is going to be fairly short term. Everybody wants to build more houses, but nobody's actually prepared to find somewhere to do it. This touches on what John was saying about people wanting to build on Greenbelt and the resistance from various groups to stop that happening. I think those people have got more political clout than perhaps the groups who are driving for more house building.
I felt as I've been interviewing people about this that we're constantly chasing the blame through all sorts of different circuits, and I think perhaps if we'd had a bit more representation of the political class, then it might have been shifted once again.
You know, it's a vast combination of factors, and I think underlying it all is a lack of will to change, basically. And I think that also follows through into the rental sector and making changes to tenancy reforms there.
Possibly because the lack of will is the people who are affected about this are the people at the bottom of the ladder, aren't they? The poor people, the people who don't have any genuinely affordable housing. There is a rant to be had later about the terminology affordable housing, and we will get there. And, you know, then you've got the renters who historically have been younger people. That's changing as the demographics of renting and who can afford to buy changes. So what you've actually got is the people who most need to be helped and the people who are most affected by the housing crisis are the people, I mean, would we agree with this, the people with the least political power?
There is that to an extent, but it's also that the benefits of building are kind of diffuse across society. It's like lots of individual people, lots of people, an entire class of society would benefit if we built more housing. But if you are talking about building housing on that particular bit of land over there, there are very specific people who will lose out from that. And it is easy to organise five people who live around the same field into an action group than it is to organise, you know, 9 million people in private rent, all of whom are working long hours to pay that private rent. The other thing that I think you need to bear in mind in this debate is that we have, as a society, we have a very odd idea of what the Green Belt looks like. I mean, people talk about the Green Belt as if it all looks like the Chilterns or the North Downs, and it's just complete nonsense. Like 59% of the Green Belt within the boundaries of London is intensively farmed agricultural land. It's basically fields covered in chemicals that are terrible for the environment, that are not open to the public to any great extent. And, you know, if you did walk along there with your dog and the dog ate something, it would probably drop dead of poisoning. This is not nice land here. But because that's not everyone's sort of mental image of it, you kind of talk about, well, maybe we should redefine the Green Belt a little bit to deal with the housing crisis. The shutters instantly come down and people start going, nope, not going to do that. There is no chance whatsoever, because if you do that, then we're going to end up with the whole of England concreted over.
Which is a nonsense, because, yeah, I mean, how much of not London, the country is built over? It's a tiny percentage.
2%, I think. It's 2 or 3. It's of that order of magnitude. It is a very, very small number. And that's not just houses, that's everything.
Does that mean then that at some point, perhaps it continues, someone somewhere has been putting forward a mirage of greenery and pleasantness around us for what, political purposes? Or
I don't think it's a specific individual. I think it's more of a sort of cultural pathology. I think it's because so much of England's idea of itself is tied up in this notion of green and pleasant fields and everything. Also, it's the branding thing at work here, isn't there? We call it the Green Belt. So you kind of, and you imagine this sort of ring of country around London, and just the fact the word green is in the name suggests something, you know, natural and beautiful. It doesn't suggest, you know, scrubland or even car parks or quarries. You know, all the other uses, all the other land uses, they're actually get folded into Green Belt. So I think the name itself is problematic here.
I think there's a temptation as well. People, when they think of building on Greenbelt, they think of acres and acres of council estates, and I think, you know, that's been one of the things that has put people off.
So there's a little bit of NIMBYism going on there, but based on a false premise.
Definitely, yes.
So if people don't want to build on Greenbelt, if people don't want to build out, then the other option is to build up, which people also get really cross about. I mean, the whole skyscrapers thing. There was a press release out today. I think there's like 260-odd towers in the offing for London. Obviously, not all of them residential. But skyscrapers also get people very exercised. But do you just want to get hold of these people and shake them and say, where are you going to put people if you don't want to build out or you don't want to build up?
Do you think that is because they're sort of harking back to the 60s and the 70s with the tower blocks, you know, concrete central post-war London, and they think that that's what building up is about, and they don't see it as being you know, necessarily a good thing.
London is really not that densely populated as cities go. Also, the most densely populated bit of London is surprisingly, it's Kensington and Chelsea. But that's not because it's all tower blocks. That's because sort of most buildings there are four or five stories, whereas most buildings in much of London are one or two. So if you look, London is less densely populated, not only than places like Hong Kong and Singapore, where it's all these sort of gleaming glass tower blocks. They're also London is also less densely populated than most European cities, because if you walk around Paris or Vienna, then the average height of buildings is, you know, five or six stories. So that's already, you're looking at 2.5 or 3 times population in any space that you can get in London. I think because of the way London has built up in the past, we kind of have this sort of idea that either it's little semi-detached houses with gardens, or it's tower blocks, and that there's nothing in between. And it's nonsense, but because we're not familiar with the options in between, we don't kind of instinctively think of those when we talk about building at higher densities.
I wanted to ask about these small changes that have been suggested, and we heard last week from Danny Dorling, who seemed to think that the process by which we could rectify things was all about a few slight adjustments that would set things straight. He was against any sudden swinging changes. And that sounds in keeping with what you've been talking about, but what he's asking sounds counterintuitive.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
If he's asking, for example, for a tax on houses, which could be easily achieved by remortgaging houses and paying off this tax, which would require, yes, change, but also something that's in the short term counter to instinct. It seems counterintuitive to me that somebody who's got their house and everything's lovely for them, that they should in any way support the idea that they then have to pay a tax. Whether or not that goes ahead is one thing, but what about the people who are renting? What changes could be expected of them? It seems we focused a lot on homeowners, but actually, are there any changes that those who are renting could make?
The difficulty we run into in the political conversation is that, like, housing is kind of is now salient enough that every party feels the need to talk about housing a little bit. Like, they all know they're going to be mocked if they don't have a housing policy. But all the housing policies they're producing are a little bit half-hearted and nonsensical, and they know they're going to get away with that because it's not going to swing anyone's vote. I mean, I one of the reasons I started this by saying how depressed I was, well, that's partly because I really thought housing was going to be a massive issue in this election campaign. And David Orr, who you spoke to last week, is you know, very committed to making it such. I just don't think it's going to climb that high up the agenda because nobody is going to switch their vote from Labour to Tory on the basis of housing policy.
Why not, if it's such a pressing issue and we all seem to agree it is?
Because this is, I mean, even by the standards of British politics, I think positions are pretty entrenched in this election. I mean, it's very, if you look at the polls, the vote share for the smaller parties has been dotted all over the place. But the two big ones, the two that could conceivably provide the next prime minister, have been pretty firmly entrenched on sort of 32-33% for quite a while now. There's just not enough motion going on for them to kind of take this kind of risk, I think.
We were actually having this conversation back in the 2012 mayoral election when, if you got hold of all the candidates in private, they would say that they thought the biggest issue was housing, but they weren't talking about housing, they were talking about transport. And I think my theory for this was that transport is something you have to deal with every single day. You get on the tube, you get that daily reminder of how much you're paying for your fare. Housing, unless you are kind of at the bottom of the ladder and you are forced to move every 6 months, you don't actually think about it every day. Mm-hmm. And I think this is possibly why it's still percolating through everybody's minds, and we're going to have to reach a proper crisis point, like even worse than we are at the minute, for it to be a proper national issue where everyone's talking about it all the time.
There's another reason why transport is higher on the agenda than housing, and that's because in transport there is no sort of class of the general public that benefits from higher rail fares, whereas there is this sort of fault line. It's not quite where people think it is, but nonetheless there is a sort of fault line between people who stand to benefit from higher house prices and people who are getting shafted by it. And that's a much more difficult issue to address politically, because any move you make to improve the lot of one set of voters runs the risk of upsetting another.
I find this remarkable, actually. It seems to me obvious that any party that came up with something credible on housing would potentially gain the votes of all the people who are floating around hoping to drum together a deposit to get onto the bottom of the ladder.
Ah, but they're not necessarily the people who vote, are they? There's this theory that, you know, if the people who vote are sort of older, homeowning, you know, very kind of entrenched, and there's this idea that young people, who would be the people who benefited most from a decent housing policy, there's no votes in it.
There are 9 million people in private rented accommodation, but they don't vote as a unit. It's not like a renters movement, because some of those people will be conservative, some of them will vote for Labour. You know, they're all over the political map, and it doesn't matter, and no single housing policy is going to kind of gather them all in one place.
I think as well, particularly in London, it's a very diverse city, and there will probably be a lot of people living here who aren't eligible to vote anyway.
Alex Hilton had a lot to say in last week's show about reforming the rights of tenants and extending tenancies, looking at some of the European models. What are your thoughts, Beth, on that?
No, I absolutely agree. I mean, I think it's certainly something that we need to do. One of the reasons that we're having this crisis at the moment is because the private rental market is just filled with horrors. If it was better regulated and tenants had proper rights and guarantees, then renting would be more appealing, and it would also prevent landlords from being able to take advantage, letting agents from being able to take advantage of both landlord and tenant, and it would just become a much more viable option for people living in London.
Really, what we've been talking about so far is, you know, building and house prices. But really, you've got two sort of separate but linked in issues. I mean, there will always be some people who want to rent and for whom renting is the best option. And yet, for some reason, we are in a situation where protections for tenants are kind of non-existent. I mean, it's terrifying how much power landlords have and still complain about that, you know, oh, I can't kick a tenant out at will. Kind of can, actually. The knock-on effect, that how the two things are related, is that as more people have no option but to rent in the private sector, the private rented sector expands, partly because we've got hardly any social housing anymore and people can't afford to get on the housing ladder themselves. So you've got this group of people who are being screwed. And the regulation, that's nothing to do with the house price crisis. That's nothing to do with people not being able to buy. It's just another addition of why housing in this country is a mess.
Oh, right, so you're disconnecting the issues. This is very much people who can't get on the ladder who are swimming about in a shark pool beneath it.
Yeah, I mean, you can sort of blame the fact that we don't have enough houses on the fact that we haven't got enough regulation.
What is the situation with the percentage, the proportion of somebody's income that they're typically spending on rent? Has that remained a constant, or is it moving?
It's through the roof, obviously. I can't remember the figures off the top of my head.
I believe it's about around 50% of people's take home.
Yeah. And is that on the rise?
It has risen, yes, very much so.
The definition of an affordable rent is a third of your take home pay, and it is way, way more than that.
I think it's also that there is a connection between the house price rise and the, you know, the situation for renters. One of the reasons it's hard to make renting a more secure option is because landlords are not only a pretty big voting bloc. They're a pretty big voting bloc that, dare I say, include quite a lot of MPs. And, you know, from their point of view, it is difficult being a landlord. You have to worry about this house you don't live in, and you have to respond to some sort of beck and call, and they say the boiler's gone. There are difficulties. You know, it's not all easy, but they can only see it from that point of view. They can't see that, you know, tenants don't feel that they're somewhere is their home because they can get chucked out at a month's notice. And also, the more, you know, the higher it is connected to house prices, because the higher house prices have gone, the more attractive property has become as an asset class as opposed to just somewhere to live. And so the more landlords have piled into the sector, so the higher prices have gone, so the fewer people can get on the ladder, so the more private renters. It becomes a sort of vicious circle like that. It is all certainly connected.
Are we finding that, because I'm not sure we've touched on this in any of the interviews, below the property ladder, I think I was only half joking about the shark pool, does that mean that people are being squeezed out of rented accommodation as well? Is that starting to happen?
I mean, every 6 months or so, I sort of look at rents and see, you know, where's the cheapest you could get if you're on the minimum wage and stuff. And even every 6 months, I can see rents in some really cheap areas of London, or what used to be cheap areas of London, going up by, rents are going up by £100 a month every 6 months. Now, that's stupid. That's ridiculous. That's not sustainable, and yet it's happening.
There seems to have been this perception as well that renting is somehow inferior, and it doesn't need to be. And I think people would be much more keen to rent if the regulation around letting agents and landlords was better.
Well, the rental situation just seems to be with rents skyrocketing as they are. It means that you can't gain any foothold, never mind whether it's on the property ladder or something else, because such a proportion of your money is going out each month on that you're locked into that, and saving for a deposit seems fanciful. So we're talking about the definition, perhaps, of what affordable is, and the disparity between the definition and the actuality. It's time possibly for Rachel's rant.
Oh yeah, my rant about affordable housing. So when people like us, normal people, talk about affordable housing, what we mean is housing that normal people can afford. But the phrase affordable housing has become co-opted, and it actually has a technical meaning. And what affordable rent now means, if you're a housing wonk, if you're part of the government, is that is now the replacement for what used to be social housing, as in council housing. So social housing can be a rent level of between about 30 to 45% of what's called normal market rent. So what you would expect to pay on the private market if you went to a estate agent, and what you would buy. Affordable rent is now what is being charged by housing associations, and anybody who's building what used to be social housing, now affordable rent housing, using government money. And there is a rent level cap associated with that, and it can be anything up to 80% of market rent. Now, that is not affordable by anybody's stretch of the imagination. It's not always up to 80%. If you get money from the GLA to build housing, it's meant to all average out across London to about 60%. I was talking to Lambeth about Nine Elms, and they have a borough-wide set of about 64% of local market rents of based across the whole borough. But it's still a hell of a lot more expensive than old social rents. And that is just the way things are going. And the reason it's risen is because the governments are putting less money into house building, and they're expecting housing associations to recoup that money from tenants.
I think it's worth putting this 80% figure in context. The redevelopment of Mount Pleasant, which, for those who don't know, is a great big post office depot in the sort of Finsbury area. They're building some flats there where the affordable rents in some of them will be £2,500 to £3,000 a month. And that's, like, if you just think of what that is as an after-tax income, you have to be earning, you know, mid to high 40s to be able to pay that. And that leaves you with no actual money for food or, you know, heating bills or anything. This is not affordable by any stretch of the imagination, but this is where we've got to. It's strangely Orwellian.
Yeah. And you can't just walk in to a housing association and ask for an affordable rent, in sarcastic air quotes, affordable rent flat, please. You have to qualify for one, which is kind of the same, or the similar criteria that used to be for social housing. I was in a meeting about housing at City Hall a year or two ago, and Kit Malthouse, who is a councillor at Westminster, was genuinely arguing that, it's okay if you've got one flat in Pimlico on 80% of market rent, because that's subsidising the three-bedroom flat on at 40% of market rent for the family. But the costs of a flat of 80% of market rent in Pimlico are going to be way, way over the amount of money that somebody who would qualify for an affordable rent, again, sarcastic air quotes, flat, would they be earning. So they're going to be needing to rely on housing benefit. So again, you've got housing benefit subsidising what should originally have been social rent housing, just because the government didn't originally put in the money from the front end to build the damn things. And it's, the whole thing is ridiculous.
And what's worse as well is that the social housing that does still exist is being sold off under right to buy. But the,
is that still happening?
Yes. In fact, the discount has increased to, I believe, is it 100,000 now? Which,
but my brain just fell out of the back of my head. We're having this discussion and they're still selling off the social housing.
Yes. Some councils are starting to create, what are basically trusts in order to hold on to their social housing. But there's still a lot of social housing that's being sold off. But the amount of money that they're making from it is not enough to build a new house. So the whole thing is just absolutely crazy.
The money from right to buy, is it even being ring-fenced for new housing anymore?
No.
Never was.
No. Yeah.
Never was.
Well, this is exactly the problem that I suggested might exist with Alex Hilton's plan to raise money through taxation and invest that into more social housing. There's no guarantee at all, is there, that money will be thus invested?
Of course there isn't. There never is with the British state. But nonetheless, I think there is a strong case for a higher tax on housing, which is simply that one of the reasons so much money is poured into housing is because it's not only been a pretty guaranteed source of growth of your pot of money over the last 30 years or so, it's also it's subject to remarkably few taxes. It's a much better thing to put your money into than almost any other asset class. If we started charging taxes on housing at a more sensible rate, then it will become less attractive as an investment, and that in itself would probably help deflate the bubble just a little bit.
And that would bring down, I was astonished to discover that affordable housing is actually pegged to the inflating housing market in percentage terms, so that would presumably help on that score as well.
Yeah, the idea of housing being some way that you live in, not an investment, kind of amazing, isn't it?
Yes.
So we're all just in awe of that whole idea, I think.
What, of living in houses?
Yeah. My God, I've been living in a bivouac for the last year and a half.
Well, we are at the point, aren't we, where housing is not being lived in. So actually we are divorcing ourselves even from the idea of living in the stuff. It seems quite clear to me from what I've heard today, from what I've heard from the experts for last week's show, that things are stuck, completely stuck. Do you actually believe that things are going to get unstuck? What's your projection?
You know what? I wish I could believe it, but I don't, because what needs to happen and the amount of bloody houses that need to be built, it's just not there. And you know what? Even if we did build more houses, I'm not even convinced that they would be of the right tenure level and in the right places and at the right affordability level to do it. I mean, yeah, we need to build more houses, but they need to be the right kinds of houses, and I'm not sure the funding model is even there to do that.
Having started this conversation by saying how depressed I was, I'm actually more optimistic than that. One of the candidates to be Labour's selection for the mayoral race next year, David Lammy, is basically going around talking about rent control and building massive amounts of social housing. Now, there's a lot of things that would have to happen for him to be in a position to implement those. For various reasons, I don't know if those things are going to happen. But nonetheless, the fact that a serious candidate for that job is proposing quite radical solutions in a way that you're not really hearing of in the general election campaign at the moment, that to me suggests the debate is shifting. How quickly it will shift to the point where we actually see some serious action is a different question, but I think we are moving in the right direction at last.
Beth, how optimistic are you?
Reasonably optimistic. I think there's, as John says, a bit of a way to go, but people, I mean, it's at least it is something that people are talking about now, and people are starting to talk about having answers to these problems. So I think we're getting there, but I don't think it's going to be something that's going to happen too quickly.
The other thing I think it's worth saying is that so much of the growth in property prices has come from the expectation of more growth in property prices. It's sort of, I don't know if a bubble is really the right word, but it's certainly a sort of bubble dynamic where more money is piled in because London property is seen as a safe investment that can only go up. So I've been wondering for a while how big a wobble we'd need to have for things to move pretty rapidly in the other direction. I think if prices in London were to drop by 10%, a lot of the investor cash would want to pull out and we'd drop by a lot further. That doesn't solve the fundamental supply problem, because in some ways it might actually make it harder. But nonetheless, I think there are reasons to think that where we are at the moment is we're not going to keep going in the same direction forever.
But you want a cooling down rather than a crash.
A crash would be traumatic for a lot of people. And so, you know, some kind of period in which prices just kind of stay reasonably stable and incomes catch up to them would be the ideal. But that's not generally how these sort of market cycles have ever worked, really. So I think the idea that we could escape a crash might be a bit optimistic.
Oh, God, I've nudged you back into depression.
I was depressed all along. You just caught me on one of my manic moments a minute ago. I've kind of gone to the other end of the scale again. I mean, the problem is something horrible. Is whatever happens from here on in, it's going to be pretty bloody horrible for someone. It's just a question of who. And I'm kind of reaching the point where I would rather it was horrible for the rich people with roofs over their head than the poor people who are being forced to move every 6 months, to be blunt about it.
On which positive note, we will have to start to draw to a close. There's one item of business left, though. Because the conversation was flowing so well, we didn't pause, as we usually do, for a sponsorship message midway. So it's at this point that I mention that we're generously supported by Audible.com, the audio book service. I use them. Some great titles on there, and some titles that our guests are going to recommend, John.
I've recently enjoyed The Complete Cabin Pressure, the Radio 4 sitcom, which isn't about houses, but is about planes.
Rachel Holdsworth.
I've just finished a book that was given to me for Christmas called Love, Nina by Nina Stibb. And it's a collection of letters that she wrote to her family while she was au pairing for a family in Primrose Hill in the 80s. It's got a lot of Alan Bennett in it, which is a good thing for me.
Beth Parnell Hopkinson.
I've just recently finished David Mitchell's The Bone Clocks, which is about pretty much everything, really.
Really?
Big book, is it?
Yeah.
And so we come to a close today. We're going to summon an ambulance immediately for Rachel Holdsworth, who we're pleased to survive this long. Thank you to my three guests today. Whatever next week's episode is about, it is sure to be cheerier than this very necessary conversation. And we give the final word to John Ellich.
Build more bloody houses.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.